RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Money talks. Farz and Irani. I don't need to say much more than that. Farz and beams in. I think from Mumbai this time, Farz. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, mate. I'm back in Mumbai. I just wanted to experience the heat wave that's happening in India. So I'm back in India now.
Okay. Okay. So you're like one of those storm chasers, except you chase heat waves, do you?
Yes, somewhat. I actually don't like the heat, mate. I struggle. My body swells up. So, but yeah, it is what it is.
Lucky it's not video. I don't want to see you swollen up. So tell me, what is the temperature? When you say heat wave, what kind of temperature are we talking?
It's getting up to 48, 50. In other parts of India, it's 55. I've heard people are passing off sunstrokes. A famous Bollywood actor called Shah Rukh Khan was taken to hospital on a shooting site that he was on because of a heat stroke. And I also heard someone actually had a brain hemorrhage while he was on the motorcycle because he was on the motorcycle with a helmet for too long. So, yeah, it's getting a bit crazy. But everyone's waiting for monsoon rain.
Is that normal, those temperatures normal, Farzan, or is this climate change related? I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's pretty normal. It's a bit hotter than usual, but I wouldn't know, mate, because this is the first time this around this time of the year that I'm even in India. I generally used to only come back to India once every 4 or 5 years around December because they had the wedding seasons and stuff like that. But I lost my father a couple of years back, and so I divide my time between, because mom and sister and the nephew are all here. And I visit clients in Asia, so it's much easier doing it from India rather than flying through from New Zealand.
All right, let's get into it at home first, and then the international side of things. So let's start off with a couple of local stories, which I think give us an idea of where things are at. Let's start off with agriculture lending trends in New Zealand. And again, thanks to interest.co.nz for putting these stories up because they really are informative. And the headline is 3 up, 2 down in terms of whether the 5 major rural lenders are growing or shrinking agriculture lending. I'm looking at some of the figures. Boy, there's a lot of money lent to agriculture in a range from $8.8 billion through to $14.9 billion. So, have you got any comments to make about this situation, the banking or the lending scene at the moment for rural lenders?
It's good to see that the New Zealand banks haven't shut up shop in the agricultural segment. They're still lending to the agricultural sector. So as you said, they all have certain market shares. What has happened in this article is talking about the amount of lending they've done in the last year and what their books now totally sit at, but also talks about whose non-performing loans in the agricultural sector have gone up. So as you mentioned, just to say, ANZ was the highest agricultural lender, obviously, because they're the biggest bank in New Zealand. And they're sitting at about $14.94 billion, closely followed by BNZ at $13.33 billion. Then comes in Rabobank, believe it or not, because they're the agricultural bank. ASB only comes in at 10.4, and Westpac is the surprise. It's at 8.75. So that's one bank that has been offloading its agricultural lending, whereas the others have kind of been increasing it. And in a way, if you read below the lines and you read through the entire article and understand statistics, Westpac, because it's done that, has actually fared better on the non-performing loans. They're the only one whose non-performing loans have actually gone down as compared to the other 4 gone up. So it's not to say that the agricultural sector is not risky. Obviously, we know because what's happened with commodities and sheep and all those prices and meat prices and dairy prices and all of that and geopolitics. The Westpac has reduced its agricultural balance sheet and its non-performing loans have gone down as well. So maybe they've just decided we're going to pull back from this segment. Just like I was looking at something there for yesterday, and ANZ has kind of pulled back from the business side of things, the business lending, it's decided to pull back or scale back, and BNZ is now the biggest business lender in New Zealand. So they all must decide what kind of ratios do they want, or leverage ratios or percentages in each segment, as I mentioned before, that they're happy to take a risk on.
Yeah, with the contraction of the economy, I think 5 quarters of GDP contraction now, I read. It possibly doesn't matter what sector you're leaning into. It's the pressures there in all of them, isn't it?
Yes, all of them. The one segment I've seen is your restaurant and travel and tourism has kind of gone back because after COVID, supposedly they're telling us that a lot of more people are coming in. You've also got to understand with us opening up our borders and a lot of migrants coming in, their first time New Zealand maybe, or second time. And now that they've decided to land and make New Zealand home, maybe they're exploring the country a bit more. That initial phase or when you come to a country, you want to see your Hamiltons and Rotoruas and your Mount Cooks and all that kind of stuff. So obviously that's adding to that. But all segments are suffering, if I'm being honest. It's the price of money that's gone up. So businesses that have debt will have a problem that they have to face or deal with.
Latest RBNZ figures show non-performing housing loans increased $136 million in April, just gone, to over $1.9 billion and are up 72% in the past 12 months. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, we've discussed the non-performing loans a couple of times, mate. The best thing, the one sentence I keep finding in there, even as I said, yes, good on interest.co.nz. They actually share some articles and they give us some hard facts and some numbers behind it so we can talk through it. The one sentence I constantly find in there is, don't worry, it's not to the level of the GFC.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Between 2009 and 2011. And as I've said before, Mike, that was a totally different ballgame. That was about 15 years back that we're talking about still those numbers, which inflation adjusted aren't even compared to what we are today. But the thing that you point out, and as you said, it's gone up by 72% in the 12 months alone. So we've mentioned this around, I think, September, again in November, that this is going to keep happening as a lag effect. As interest rates keep going higher, people are going to be in trouble servicing their mortgage debt or their business debt or their car debt. There was also an article this morning on somewhere else saying a lot of people are taking on a bit of credit card debt and 90 days overdue and all that kind of stuff. There's a breakdown of those numbers. In this article alone, loans that are 90 days past due, but not impaired. Impaired is when it's 90 days overdue and it's really gone bad. And now the bank's trying to figure out how to dispose of the property or what do we do next because the client can't get out of arrears anymore. So loans that are 90 days past overdue, but not impaired, have pushed through the $1.5 billion mark, surging by 116 million or 8% compared to April 2023. So 1.5 billion, that's 1,500 million loans in New Zealand that are 90 days past due.
Okay. Well, that's, if you say it like that. One thing in this story that caught my eye says here, RBNZ monthly figures showing what terms people are refixing their mortgages and that most are now fixing their interest rates for 12 months or less. And they say that's a clear expectation that rates will be coming down sooner rather than later. Really?
Yeah. They just keep selling the same Kool-Aid, mate. And it just doesn't. I don't know who's drinking the Kool-Aid they're selling, but they've been talking about these rate cuts coming, as I told you. They're going to keep making these promises and say, just hang in there. First home buyers, yeah, now's a good time because rates will be coming down. Or don't worry, it's going to get better. It ain't getting better, mate, unless there's a massive global shock like we had, like a COVID event. They're hoping for a massive shock. Now, it could be so many different ways this could happen. But if that happens, then obviously they'll get a reason. As I said, now people can think through this. There was massive liquidity problems, something similar happening around September 2019, as I mentioned. And I knew they would have to throw some event at us to kind of create liquidity and drop interest rates again, because the entire financial system was stuck. It was in trouble. And then magically, a few months later, we had this global pandemic and they had a reason to shut us down so we could print lots of money and give everyone free money, sit at home and reduce interest rates. So there could be something coming for them to reduce interest rates. But I think, as we mentioned before, the reduced interest rates, again, inflation goes up even further because they print more money. Given what we're looking at, it's not going to be pretty because this time people will have seen what happened 3 years back. Hopefully they won't pile into the mortgage market But inflation will take off again.
Yeah, they're talking in that story about interest rates staying about where they are until mid-2025. So that's a bit of time to run still.
So as I mentioned, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand had said we might reduce interest rates. We're in pause since last May. We're now in June this year. So for 12 months, there's been no movement. Obviously, they have to pause it because it'll break the economy if they keep raising it. And at that stage, it said maybe towards the end of 2024. We're June now, we're in the 6 month. And I think a couple of weeks or a couple of months back, we discussed, and I said now they've moved it to 2025. So that's exactly what this article is saying, that the Reserve Bank itself is saying nothing's going to happen. We're not going to look at reducing interest rates till the second half of 2025, which is next year. And obviously, because they see inflation in the economy still. And the one thing I want, again, we've explained inflation in so many different ways. You know, when they say inflation's come down to 2%, what I want people to realize also, sometimes they talk about month-on-month inflation, or sometimes they talk about year-on-year inflation. So when we had the 9 or 10%, it has never gone back to that. So when they talk about month on month, they might say last month the inflation was 4, look, this month it's 3.5 and stuff like that. But the 3.5 is on top of the 4 last month, which is on top of the 10% last year. So it's never going back to the 2019 prices unless we have a real big disinflation or a deflation event, which will take place when there's massive job losses. So job losses on a bigger scale will trigger that, but people don't have jobs. Obviously, prices will have to start coming up, which I've heard is happening with Amazon and the Walmarts in America, where they've decided to start reducing prices en masse. But this is it. Inflation is never going back. Nothing that you used to buy in 2019 at a certain price is going back to that. I mean, the majority. I would love to hear a story where someone says, I got this cheaper than I did in 2019. Especially consumables like food and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, the way inflation is talked about is a good point. And that hides what you've just said, that cumulatively over even 2 or 3 years, you know, if you look back at prices that far ago, it's more than just the rate you're experiencing at the moment, right? Way more.
Yes, and it piles on, as I mentioned, right? And the one thing I want to explain again, you know, why these reserve banks around the world, or let's just say, we just talk about the New Zealand, their excuse, as I told you, it is an excuse, that inflation is high, so we have to increase interest rates. And they know by increasing interest rates, they're going to create problems for businesses and problems for people's jobs and make it really hard for people who have debt and services. Now, there's a demand side and a supply side. In the 1970s, and I think I've explained this one once before as well, in the 1970s, obviously in America and stuff, there were shortages in the 1970s with the oil embargo. But after the 1940s onwards, people were coming back home. It was the boomer generation after World War II and rebuilding at home and getting into new gadgets and new microwaves and all that kind of stuff. So when it's a demand-driven event, inflation, okay, because a lot of people are coming in, and as I've explained, let's say there's only 100 houses. In New Zealand, we have a housing shortage. So there's only, let's just say there's 100 houses and they've just let in an extra 150 immigrants. So now it's a demand side driven. There's more demand for housing and that's why prices go up. Now, they it's okay to raise interest rates in that scenario because it dampens demand, which is what they're trying to say the Reserve Bank is doing. We're increasing interest rates so people stop borrowing and bidding up prices of things. Now, food, I don't think anyone's bidding that up. But at some point in the system, confidence breaks down when the interest rates go too high, right? Because everyone, and that's what you're seeing with this lag effect, and people getting in trouble with their mortgages, with the non-performing loans, the interest rates are already too high for people to service the existing debt. So now if the Reserve Bank keeps increasing interest rates, it's not a demand-driven. There's no demand. Not everyone's just going out and flipping houses anymore or just taking on debt for the sake of debt, right? So at some point in the system, confidence breaks down. And high interest rates only add to the cost of production and doing business. So now if your business with the higher interest rates, if you're paying 2 or 3%, now if you're paying 6 or 7%, you have to service your debt. Now my cost of production has gone up. And that obviously means what? Either I suffer and I shut up shop, or I have to pass on the cost of those goods to the consumer who's buying my product. which is inflation for them again on top of the high interest rate. So it's a very cool balancing act that the Reserve Bank has to do, but they're not clearly telling us the truth, because this is not a demand-driven thing. There's so much debt in the system that if they keep increasing interest rates, people are going to go broke. People are going to lose homes. But as I mentioned before, maybe that is the plan.
Yeah, maybe it is. And with unemployment sharply increasing now, starting to, then that impairment figure that we started talking about is just going to go up, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And unemployment numbers already going up. And I think last week we also discussed it in the government sector, took off 4,000 jobs. So, yes, that was a saving of $400 million on the budget side. But that's 4,000 people who now have to start looking for jobs. Obviously, they'll probably go on the benefit or something initially. But there's just not that many job ads in the New Zealand market. And especially people who are doing all these little soft jobs, not productive jobs in the economy. They were pencil pushers, or if I'm being honest, as we call them, bureaucrats, with the DEI agendas and the green agendas and all of that. They're not your plumbers. They're not the hardworking people. Your plumbers, the people are building our roads, the building, manufacturing, all of that stuff. They're not adding to the productive GDP. They were a drain on society and a drain on our economic, say, social growth for our country, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, there's possibly some hard times coming for a lot of people. Let's hope it's not too hard. And just to finish up on the local scene, New Zealand Trading Bank leverage tables have been published as well. I'm looking at it. Okay, I could pore over it for hours and probably figure it out, but you've taken a look. What is it showing?
Well, the reason I want to discuss that is obviously it's trying to show us what the New Zealand Bank's positions were back in the days, and also it's talking about what it is now. So I just want to go through a certain thing because I came across something where they said, oh, New Zealand banks are doing really well because they've reduced their leverage. Now, I will explain what leverage essentially is. But let's say, for example, again, if my income is 100 and I have 300 in debt, just a very simple example. It's not that simple, but my leverage ratio is 1:3 because my income is 100, but my debt is 300. So it's saying how much you are out on the ledge about to be dropped off. Banks prefer 1 to 2. So you only want about double leverage, depending on the business, the sector of the economy you're playing in, all that demand-driven factors. But to give you an example, I'm not picking any individual bank. So they have said that the leverage ratios have come down. So I'll just give you an example. ANZ, for example, was in March 2020. Their leverage ratio was 12:1. And in March 2024, their leverage ratio is down to 10.5. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's about 1.6% is down. But what I want, this is, and I'll explain the other banks after I've explained what leverage is so you can understand what I'm talking about. Leverage is essentially the number of times the total assets of a bank, right? Their loans and advances. When I say assets, our liabilities are a bank's assets because they've lent us that money. So it refers to the number of times total assets of a bank, their loans and advances to us, to people, to businesses, are larger than the shareholder investment in the bank.
Okay.
So what I'm trying to get is, as we mentioned before, a bank's balance sheet has shareholder capital and a bank gets wiped out when either its assets, let's say we have residential properties and commercial properties on one side, and if the loan starts shrinking on one side, your shareholder capital gets literally wiped out. So in this case, this very simple example I've given you is it's saying ANZ as of March 2024, its leverage ratio is 10.5. So shareholder capital, let's say if it was $10, it has lent out $100, okay? Its leverage is 10.5. It's 10 times what its shareholders' capital is. And it takes only a small percentage of your back book to go bad before your shareholder capital gets wiped out, which is another thing, as I said, in Europe, when the banks were failing, Credit Suisse last year, the shareholders were completely wiped out. The shareholders get wiped out completely if you own a bank. They take the first hit, then it comes to unsecured creditors, then it comes to certain kind of covered bonds, and then comes your deposits, if that's the case. But, and I'm not singling out ANZ, so I will just give you some more. BNZ's leverage ratio from March 2020 has gone from 13.7 down to 10.1 as well. So what they're trying to tell you, again, the leverage ratio has improved. The best one in there is Rabobank. Their leverage ratio is only 7 times their book, their shareholder capital. The highest, if I'm looking at, is the same core bank. Again, I've not made these numbers. I'm just reading it off a screen. The smaller banks are in the 12s. Core bank is at 13. And with the big banks, when I say the big banks, TV Bank is sitting at a 13.9. So they've reduced the leverage ratio from 16 to 13.9, which is the largest in the big four banks. Okay. But right. Rabobank has the lowest leverage ratio of how much the shareholder capital is, so how much they've lent out in the economy. As I've said, this is so now when we talk about the OBR, when we talk about something like fractional reserve banking, when we say there's only 10 cents for every dollar they lend out, this is all right there. And it's clearly giving you the data of what it is. Nothing I'm making up out yet. These are all available data on RBNZ's website and stuff as well. So if you're with a certain bank, go look at their leverage ratios and try and figure out what's going on.
Yet the annualized profits, I'm looking at the after tax, compared to March 2020, I suppose it is, and now 2024, have all gone up.
Well, profits will keep going up, mate. And if somebody's interested, I'm happy to talk about, profits are going to keep going up. Again, as I said, we've discussed this, the money doesn't exist. So if you lend money out of thin air, then
you're going to make more money. Yeah. If people can pay it back. Yeah, you will. Yeah.
There's only shareholder capital and there's your few amount of deposits that are on your balance sheet. And there's other four sources of lending that the New Zealand banks might have done either from the Australian parent or from overseas investors looking for a better yield than sitting in Japan or Europe at negative interest rates. So obviously that's where it comes from. But everything else is fugazi, right? Because they've lent out that much money, and there's only 80 or 70% of the property sitting on their balance sheet. Now, as we've said on this side, when the property keeps going down, obviously the loans, as you see, are non-performing loans, they're going down. So this is what I'm saying. You have a small problem in the economy, and it quickly wipes off the shareholder capital on the balance sheet. And pretty much that's when you have something like an OBR event, open bank resolution, which RBNZ says could be in trouble. But something I just want to also say is when I dig more into the deep data, the same numbers that I said, and I'll just talk about ANZ in this case. In March 2008, they were at 12%. Okay. Now we're going to 2008, where they were at 12% leverage. And in December 2010, their leverage went up to almost 15.6%. So what you can see is the leverage actually went higher after the global financial crisis, as there was more risk in the system, even though the house prices were going down and New Zealand didn't experience that much, the leverage ratios of all the banks went up, moving from 08 to December 10, other than kind of ASB, they went from 20 down to 16.7. So ASB going into the financial crisis had a 20 leverage ratio and they reduced it to 16.7. So I'm assuming they had a bad time in the global financial crisis, whereas ANZ was only at 12%, they went up to 15.6. So they took the slack off ASB in this. I hope that made sense. I know on the radio, some capitalization, all those ratios don't make sense, but
No.
I'm just trying to share some basic numbers.
That made sense. All right, let's leave NZ, though we're still part of the global picture. A couple of things come to mind. There's a G7 coming up, and there's that $300 billion, I think, of Russian assets that, well, you know, some people use the word steal, that's about to be stolen by, I guess, the EU or NATO or that grouping, the collective West, as they're known, to fund, well, rebuilding of Ukraine. Good luck with that. There's also, you know, sabers rattling and talk of war. So what do you make of the international situation, Farzan, right now?
Let's start off on the war thing. Yes, you're right. Obviously, it is escalating really quickly. And we mentioned this, no news year in a way. Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, and Belgium have pretty much said that it's okay to, they're going to support and train Ukraine pilots and stuff to use US-approved F-16 fighter jets to attack Russia in Russia. So this is a serious escalation because Russia said if we see them and we drop them off the skies, we know it's being used because it's a NATO country. You should run a NATO and all countries have to get involved. That's what they're hoping for. They're really hoping that Russia will just attack a NATO country so they can say, look, it was Russia who took the action first. And because Russia is not biting back, they are instigating Russia on so many fronts. In fact, it's funny you say that because in Switzerland, as we know, the Davos crowd is hosting 80 countries for a peace summit, believe it or not. It's called a peace summit to talk about Russia and Ukraine. And they have decided not to invite Russia itself. So China's gone, stuff here, we're not coming either. Because, you know, this is not really a peace summit to talk about these kind of things. It's just they must be getting ready for the plans of how to do this because they know the Ukraine has lost this war. How do they keep this facade going and somehow get Russia to attack first? Which leads us into what I'm trying to also say is what you mentioned before, that they have the G7 countries meeting up on June 13th, and they're also going to discuss what do we do with the $300 billion of Russian assets, reserves, that we have frozen since we decided to do this brain dead policy. And there's one or two, one of three things. The first one is obviously just take the 300. But Russia and Putin has clearly, because Putin doesn't bluff, let's be honest, right? When he says he's going to do something, he just goes ahead and he kind of does it. They're trying to cross his red lines, and this is one of the red lines. So he said, if you confiscate the $300 billion, that will be an act of war because it's our money. So as you see, for the last 2 or 3 months, they've been talking about it, but nothing's really happened. So they float the idea out there. The second plan out there is they will possibly issue $50 billion in bonds to give Ukraine money, obviously, as an excuse, and also to say, okay, there you go, use this money for arms shipments, this, that, but also build your infrastructure again because you're getting bombed and all that kind of stuff. Now, if Ukraine takes the $50 billion, what is the collateral behind it? So they're saying they'll use the $300 billion of Russian frozen assets, because right now they're frozen assets as collateral for the bonds. What do you think happens? Ukraine defaults on the $50 billion in bonds. The underlying collateral, which is Russian treasury, is taken away because that's your collateral. As I said, if you miss your mortgage payments, they take your house. So they're trying to say, well, let's issue $50 billion. So we're not stealing Russia's money, but we'll give Ukraine $50 billion in bonds, and the underlying collateral will be the $300 billion. The third talk of the town is that let's just use the interest instead, okay? But the interest on that is about $3.5 billion a year. So that's for the last 2 years of this war and stuff, it would be about $6.5 to $7 billion. So they're saying that because they know if they do these stupid brain dead things, they're essentially at war with Russia. And I wouldn't put it past them, mate. We've seen actions coming out of the White House and some European and NATO countries. They know this will escalate very quickly. And as I've said, this time it's not just normal. You're not attacking Iran. I think Napoleon and Hitler have tried going into Russia and they've realized very quickly what happens. But this time we're talking supersonic missiles. We're talking nuclear weapons, nuclear countries. It's just, this is just brain dead stuff because we could be sleeping one night and the next thing we know is something's dropped on us. So it's crazy what these politicians, they're playing with fire, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I saw an interview with a Russian military expert just the last few days, and he said that he thought the chance of a conflict, as we're discussing now, was up in the 99% range. 99%. There's no reporting of any of the developments here in New Zealand, Farzan, you won't be surprised to hear, because that's us these days. But, you know, with nuclear weapons, like you say, the missiles, I think you said supersonic. I think they do hypersonic now, which is like 10 times the speed of sound. There's absolutely no way of stopping them. And Russia will, you know, its military doctrine calls for a nuclear strike after a certain level is met, and it's getting close. So it could be that... I don't know how long it takes to get to that, but it could be that there are not too many conversations left to be had because the world is on the edge of a cliff, it seems, but no one is really talking about it here anyway. No one.
Yeah, it's surprising how the New Zealand media, I'm not there reading the newspapers, but obviously everything, all the newspapers and stuff are online now. And that is why you've got to keep a global hat, right? Because we're sitting in New Zealand thinking, oh yeah, she'd be right, everything's going all right. But again, think about this. In India, they just had the IPL finished. Now there's a cricket 2020 World Cup, as I said. During the Roman Empire, when an empire is collapsing, they have bread and circuses. We have sport, okay? You just give people sport. And now what is it? I think rugby season started out there as well.
Yep.
So you just keep the masses preoccupied with firstly going to two jobs instead of one if you can, so they just pay off their debt. And then in the evening, he's just happy to come home, have a beer and watch the footy, the rugby, whatever his sport of choice is. But this is where people are distracted and then history changes so quickly. You're absolutely right, because we've been talking about World War III for, well, almost 9 months, 12 months. Yeah. And I've never not once said it's a smaller war. I have said it is going to World War III, which we are. It's not like it's going to be on this exact date World War III started. It has already begun. I already know the country is going on which side. It is Russia, China, North Korea and Iran, which will front up, because they know if they keep going after Russia, China's not going to sit aside, because they know they'll be the next person. Back in geopolitics, back in the days, the U.S. policy was to keep Russia and China apart, because if they got together, they would be combined stronger than the U.S. So they're doing all this brain dead stuff, obviously, because they have a brain dead president in office, right? So he's not running the show. He doesn't even appear for 30% of his meetings, mate. So anyone who wants anything can just get everything signed off. And there's what they call the neocons running the show behind the scenes. The one thing I've also heard is obviously Ukraine's not coming back. So even the BlackRock's and the JP Morgan's have invested money thinking that they will make so much more money building up Ukraine again after it is slightly destroyed. I can tell you, maybe I think there won't be a slight destruction. There will be nuclear bombs dropped on Ukraine, just to make a point by Russia saying, is this what you really want?
Well, sorry to interrupt, but the interview I heard that I referred to just before, the Ukraine is seen as part of Russia. So, and the people substantially have Russian heritage. So no, they won't attack Ukraine, is what he said. This won't happen. Who they will attack is possibly Poland, possibly the UK, anywhere where there's, like you referred, the command and control of the weaponry that's being brought in through NATO, like the F-16s, some of the guidance for the missile systems. You know, they're not on location. They're in other parts of the world. And the military doctrine of these, say the Soviet Union, it's not as Russia, isn't it, calls for them to be destroyed. If they're following their doctrine, that's what will happen. And here's the other thing. We're on the side of Ukraine. We've given them $100 million. I asked Winston Peters on the show, what for? What are the line items? He couldn't tell me. So this is just a black hole. So where are we in this?
You're right about a few things there, Paul, and about a lot of things, but I haven't heard that interview. Kyiv, yeah. Kind of also, obviously, first it was the USSR, and now there's Russia. So there was a few countries that broke up and separated. But Putin is quite nostalgic about Ukraine and Kyiv, because that is where the Rus originate from. But do you remember where were bombs dropped in Japan? They weren't dropped in Tokyo. They weren't dropped in the main city. It was a warning message. They were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So when you drop those, you're trying to make a point. You're not trying to necessarily destroy the capital. So he might do something like that. He could attack, but if he, this is what I'm saying, they want him to attack the likes of Poland or one of the other countries. Even Sweden is doing silly things. Even though during COVID, they were one of the smartest countries, now they're doing stupid things. But if he attacks one of those, then they've got an excuse saying you attacked a NATO country. But essentially, if they use their planes, it is essentially NATO attacking. And now he's figured it out, right? It was because he didn't go to war with Ukraine. It was a special military exercise.
Yeah. He was trying to get them to the negotiating table. Like, okay, we don't want this. We better talk with these guys. And he
did. Right.
But then Boris Johnson apparently turned up and scuppered the whole thing. So, but whether or not the NATO or the collective West can blame them for bombing somewhere and therefore initiate a war, it doesn't matter. It's all over anyway. You know?
It is, mate. Why do you think everyone's drafting their citizens in the military, right? So Germany had stopped it. They're bringing it back, and they're going to go up to about a 60-year age. Can you believe that? 60 years, right? They're that desperate to have people. They're going to also get women to join. And it's not just them. There's certain countries that obviously have the conscription in the army. It's the UK, Rishi Sunak now saying, if I get elected, I'll do that compulsory stuff. So obviously these European countries are doing this. They know they have to go to war. And as I just said, they have to go to war because the financial system is collapsing. Can you imagine entire population of your country has lost everything? Do you think you're going to survive? Do you think you survive that? No, so they need World War III to blame it. And this happened after World War II. There's a thing called Bretton Woods, where then that's where the G7 countries came out of, where they thought they were the G7 most popular, the majority countries, the ones with the most power and the biggest GDP, sitting together and deciding what the new next financial system of the world was going to be. And that was going to be everything linked to the US dollar and the US dollar linked to gold. And this is exactly what I'm trying to tell you, is the system is on its last legs. They will kick over the table, but it's not us. We didn't do anything wrong, guys. It was the war. So now this is what has happened. There's been destruction and devastation. We need a new monetary system to rebuild everything. And they will blame it on someone else for them squandering all your superannuation, all your savings. They will not be able to pay all the promises that were made. As I said, government bonds are the underlying security for about 90% of the money running around in the world, even though it's Fugazi.
And here's another thing. But wait, there's more, Farzan. I don't know if you caught up with the story that was out yesterday in the Telegraph. Pretty well a mainstream media outlet in the UK, right? UK, The Telegraph. COVID vaccines may have helped a fuel rise in excess deaths. A study out of the Netherlands, which analyzed data from 47 Western countries and discovered there had been more than 3 million excess deaths since 2020, with the trend continuing despite the rollout of vaccines and containment measures. They're describing it as unprecedented, the figures. So here's the other thing. What happens when everybody realizes that potentially their health could have been severely damaged or their relatives have died as a result of that? How does an economy work when you've got 70, 80, 90% of the population hopping mad, wanting to deal to the people who pulled that move on them? That surely has an economic downside as well.
I think I previously mentioned this, right? There's cycles. There's different cycles. Unfortunately, in the next 8 years, there's about three different cycles. So if it's only one playing out, it's a major impact anyways. There's about three playing out. There's war cycles, there's disease cycles, and there's your monetary crisis cycle. So there's a lot of cycles playing out now. And this is going to be the big bang. So there's a lot of cross currents. Now, if you think about what's happening with the COVID, obviously, let's say even if 30 or 40% of your population is disabled, which the government actually, remember once we talked about insurance data and all that kind of stuff? Because the government is pretty much paying super annuance. If you're 65 and over, you're getting benefit from the government. The fewer 65-year-olds we have in a country, I'm not saying New Zealand government, any government in Australia, 60-year-olds, the less expenses they have, okay? So that's one way of that. What you're talking about, as I've mentioned, there will be riots in the street because every citizen around the world is waking up that the government does not have the best interest. What is happening in the next 6 to 8 years, not only from a monetary perspective, the COVID lies that is now coming out, and this is across the world. I saw something yesterday where a Filipino member of parliament has literally said, we need a thorough investigation, which obviously is happening in New Zealand right now, but in Australia
as well. We don't know yet. We're waiting to hear. We hope, but
The Japanese doctors have come out in parliament and said that this was absolutely a kill shot. In Philippines, this has come out now. They're saying kids, young kids who are 13, 14, 15, acting like 60 or 70-year-olds and falling sick all the time. Now their immune systems are absolutely rubbish. I yesterday actually had to go to a funeral. The elderly are now getting dementia and passing away. There's a lot of heart attacks and strokes and blood clots even in India. So people are waking up. People don't trust their governments. And over the next year or two, as I said, as this escalates, people go, first it was the COVID, then it was this. Why are they shutting down our farmers? Why are they affecting our food just for climate change? Then the people have figured out that they were actually lied to and given the kill shot. And if they have 6 months or 3 years to live, they're going to be pissed off. But now come to 2030s, what do you think happens? And remember, there's always you've got to distract the people with the new thing, right? So as more and more of this comes out, that's why they need war as well. Because, hey, you know what? Everyone in the world is talking about these COVID vaccines have caused harm. So now the war drums have to beat. And now in the newspapers, there'll be talk about war every day or a government collapsing somewhere or something like that. So you're distracted from the COVID scene. Let's bring the next circus act so we can forget about the previous circus act. That's what this is. But between now and 2030, as I've said, it collapses because no more citizens will believe that the government has their best interest. So the government tries to, let's say, I'm not saying it is the case, but if they knew that people should have the choice of taking it and they were forced, and Fauci's testimony yesterday or
it should never have been offered. It should never have been offered. Forget about choice. No one should ever have had the choice at all. It should never have been available.
Think about this, Paul. Think about this. When you get flu or when you get a headache or stomach bug, does the government say, hey, you have to do this? No. You yourself go to the doctor and try and fix yourself. But that's why I said it was the media propaganda all over the world. Sit at home, watch the news every day at 1 o'clock. It had to be a circus act where everyone had to sit there in front of the ringmaster, if you know what I'm trying to say, who the ringmaster is, watch my show, okay? And this is how you psychologically manipulate the population who actually bother to sit in front of a television to watch this rubbish, okay? So it's been going on for years, mate. It's only now that COVID has given a mass awakening of people. And not even then, it's, I think, now when people are losing family members and people are falling sick all the time. They're going, why am I bloody falling sick all the time now? That is what I'm hearing. Why am I falling sick all the time?
Why do I, you know, some people are on their fourth or fifth or sixth COVID bout. Well, that's an epic fail for a vaccine, isn't it? But
Not a vaccine. It's not a vaccine. That's why people don't get it. I have to explain it to some people saying, this wasn't a vaccine, mate. It's biological engineering. And you've actually let someone put something that you have no idea inside your body and your bloodstream. It's called the spike protein. Go Google.
It's gone into your cell and it's overwritten part of your DNA and you're screwed, potentially. But anyway. Oh, dear. Well, we've got a lot to think about. We're up against time now, so let's end it there. But that was another great chat. Thanks for sort of leading us around those numbers related to New Zealand. And yeah, it's probably, well, I wasn't around in World War II, though I've heard relatives talk about it. This seems to be like one of the most desperate situations upon us since that time. So let's hope cool heads prevail and smart people can guide us through. But well, I don't know about you. I'm feeling a little bit nervous. I don't want to spook the listeners, but you can feel, you know, the temperature's rising, right?
And hope is not a strategy, let's be honest. You've got to prepare. You always have insurance, not for after the fire. You just have insurance before the fact, right? Now, some people say which countries are safest and this and that. Some people say New Zealand, Australia will be safe, but because it's that far off, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, but
because,
still,
again, we're on the wrong side.
The way we live is going to change so dramatically if all this happens.
Yeah. But it also doesn't mean forget the life change, right? Like, honestly, we're self-sufficient on food. But let's say if there's a Middle East war and there's nuclear weapons being exchanged out there as well, where are we getting our petrol and oil and diesel and all that stuff? Don't forget that.
What happened to the refinery?
It's not just a nuclear bomb that kills you. There's famine. There's a lot of volcanoes going off, which puts ash in the sky, and that could cause actually cooling.
Well, nuclear winter.
Agriculture.
Nuclear winter.
Yeah, exactly. Your crops aren't growing and all that kind of stuff. But again, we don't want to end on a thing. I just want to give hope, because we all going to, not everyone's going to survive, as I said, whether it's through famine in certain countries, whether it's disease cycles in certain countries, whether it's a nuclear Armageddon, the whole thing is humanity collectively survives. Now, let's hope some of us make it on that side. But this is what I'm saying, there's light at the end of the tunnel, because as people are waking up, as you're just saying, smarter heads prevail. They've had 2 years for smarter heads to prevail. And in fact, they didn't need to instigate this war. They're instigating it because they know their system is collapsing. Okay, so they have to do this. So don't think that world war ain't going to happen. It has already begun. I've already told you this, and now it's going on multiple fronts. When there's 3-4 wars on different fronts with China, Taiwan, I think North Korea, South Korea, and all of that stuff, Iran with the Middle East and all that Israel stuff, then those four combine into one big one and becomes officially World War III, but it's already begun. But the hope at the end of this is when the citizens wake up and think this was all being done on purpose. And the reason I'm happy is because this monetary cycle, especially, I want it to collapse like right now. Yeah. Because without a war, that would be great, right? Because then they can't print more Fugazi to keep funding the war for longer, which it won't if there's a nuclear boom and it's over. But what happens at the end of the cycle, mate? Then politicians globally, right, will be faced to actually start solving problems rather than just papering them over by borrowing and squandering billions and trillions. Because right now, when we have a plug, or this went wrong, or let's just borrow some more money and spend it here and borrow some more money and spend it there. When the punch bowl is taken off from governments, which is the bond market, when people and entities say, nah, stuff here, we know you're never going to pay our bonds back, and that credit from governments is taken away, they can fund fewer wars, and the politicians will really have to start solving real problems rather than just papering them over with fake money.
Let's end on that note. How do people get in touch with you, Farzan? Please remind us.
Yeah, sure, mate. The website's called successsimplified.life. Read through the page, flick me an email. Happy to help.
Thanks again, Farzan. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, mate. Cheers. Take care.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.